The discerning cell. The subtle intelligence of the T cell. For centuries, the thymus has been an organ in search of a function. Jacques Miller, 2014. In 1961, a 30-year-old PhD student in London, Jacques Miller, discovered the function of a human organ that most scientists had long forgotten. The thymus, so named because it vaguely resembles the lobe-shaped leaves of the thyme plant, was, as Galen described it, a bulky and soft gland that sits above the heart. Even Galen, practicing medicine in the 2nd century AD, noted that it slowly involuted as humans grew older. And when the organ was removed from adult animals, nothing significant happened. A dwindling, dispensable, involuting organ. How could it possibly be essential for human lives? Doctors and scientists began to think of the thymus as a vestigial detritus left behind by evolution, not unlike an appendix or a tailbone. But might it have a function during fetal development? Using minute forceps and the thinnest silk sutures, Miller removed the thymus from neonatal mice about 16 hours after birth. The effect was as unexpected as it was dramatic. The blood level of lymphocytes, the white cells in the circulation that are not macrophages or monocytes, dropped precipitously, and the animals became increasingly susceptible to common infections. B cells dropped in number, but some other white cell, a previously unknown type, was diminished even more dramatically. Many of the mice died of the mouse hepatitis virus. Many had bacterial pathogens colonize their spleens. Stranger still, when Miller placed a piece of foreign skin on the animal's flank, the graft was not rejected. Rather, it remained alive and intact, growing luxuriant hair. It was as if the mouse had no mechanism to distinguish its own tissues from foreign tissues. It had lost its sense of self. By the mid-1960s, Miller and other researchers had realized that the thymus was far from vestigial. In newborns, it was the site of maturation for a different kind of immune cell, not a B cell, but a T cell, T for thymus. But if B cells generated antibodies to kill microbes, what did T cells do? Why were the mice that lacked T cells colonized by infections? And why did they so meekly accept foreign skin grafts that should have been rejected immediately? How and why did they lose their sense of self? And what is the self, anyway? It is a testament to the infancy of cell biology as a science that the physiology of one of the most essential cells of the human body remained a mystery as late as the 1970s. T cells were discovered only about 50 years ago, and it was barely 2 decades after Miller's experiment in 1981 that these cells would become the epicenter of one of the defining epidemics in human history. Alan Towson's lab sat atop a steep hill at the Institute for Molecular Medicine, now called the Wetherall Institute of Molecular Medicine, at the edge of Oxford University. In the fall of 1993, when I arrived at Oxford to study with Alan as a graduate student in immunology, the mysteries of T-cell function were still being deciphered. The institute was a modernist steel and glass building. The security guard at the front desk, a woman with a thick Welsh accent, checked IDs before letting you in. Without the right card, she would refuse to let you enter. 2 years passed with me fumbling through my pocket for the card until I finally got the courage to confront her. I had been there every day for 24 straight months. Didn't she recognize me by my face? She looked at me stonily. I'm just doing my job. Her job, I suppose, was to detect intruders. As if I might well have been James Bond, who'd driven up the hill in an Aston Martin and a Mukherjee mask on a top-secret mission to feed my T-cells cultures at night. In retrospect, I've grown to appreciate her diligence. She had internalized immunity. In Alan's lab, I was assigned a problem that continues to fascinate and frustrate scientists. How does a chronic virus, such as herpes simplex virus, HSV, cytomegalovirus, CMV, or Epstein-Barr virus, EBV, remained hidden persistently inside the human body, while other viruses, such as influenza, are completely eliminated after infection? Why aren't the chronic viruses vanquished by the immune system, especially by T cells? Each of these viruses, we now know, has evolved a specific method of avoiding immune detection, a phenomenon called viral immune evasion. In the case of EBV, the immunologist Maria Masucci's studies and my own graduate work converged on the same answer. The genome of the Epstein-Barr virus encodes many genes, but once it enters B cells, EBV can turn off most of these genes, except for two, EBNA1 and LMP2. The protein EBNA1 would be an ideal candidate for T cells to detect, but surprisingly, it is invisible to them. Part of the reason is that EBNA1 resists being chopped up into pieces inside the cell. As we shall soon learn, Alan Townsend discovered that T cells can recognize only pieces of viral proteins, peptides, loaded on a molecule known as major histocompatibility complex, abbreviated MHC. And EBNA1, it turns out, doesn't produce any peptides. LMP2 may have other means of immunoevasion, but these aren't yet known. Herpes simplex virus relies on a different approach to immune evasion, disabling the mechanism by which peptides are transported to be loaded onto the MHC molecules. Likewise, cytomegalovirus has yet another evasive maneuver. It makes a protein that can destroy MHC, the very molecule that enables T cells to spot a CMV-infected cell. The lab was a buzzing intellectual paradise, full of a frenetic energy that I had never encountered. At 4 in the afternoon, an old brass bell clanked, and the whole institute descended en masse to the cafeteria to consume weak, lukewarm, nearly undrinkable tea and tough, nearly inedible biscuits. Ida Askenas, one of the pioneers of immunology, used to occasionally hold court in a corner. Sidney Brenner, the Nobel-winning geneticist from Cambridge, might drop in for a casual chat, his fabulously bushy eyebrows, like twin caterpillars, lifting and waving with joy every time we told him of a new experimental result. An Italian postdoc, Vincenzo Sorrentolo, was my direct mentor. Sorrentolo, known as Enzo, was short, garrulous, and effervescent. Yet, during my first weeks in the lab, he ignored me entirely. He rushed around the lab, navigating his way past me as if I were some irritating piece of equipment that someone had offloaded in the wrong place. He was trying to finish a research paper, and teaching a freshly arrived graduate student the rococo details of immunology seemed hardly worth his time or energy. One aspect of Enzo's project involved manufacturing viruses to infect mouse and human cells. The virus was designed to deliver genes into human cells so that Enzo could test the gene's functions. To expand the virus, that is, to make more viral particles, you had to infect a layer of cells. Then you extracted the virus by placing the whole culture in a tube and freezing and thawing it exactly 3 times. It was a procedure that required precision and patience. Without freeze-thawing, you could not release the viral particles. But if you overdid the process, you might kill the virus entirely. One morning, soon after I had arrived in the lab, I found Enzo fussing over one such tube. A research technician, also Italian, had made a viral prep for him, but she had left for a vacation, and Enzo had no idea whether the virus had been extracted or whether the tube had been left without the viral extraction. It was a tense moment. A low viral count and the whole experiment, critical to his paper, would go down the drain. He cussed in Italian under his breath, "Cavolo." I asked him whether I could look at the tube, and he handed it to me. On its bottom, in barely visible ink, I saw that the technician had scribbled the letters C-S-C-S-C-S. "What's the word for freeze in Italian?" I asked him. "Congelare," Enzo replied. "And for thaw?" "Scongelare." So that's what the technician had written. Freeze, thaw, freeze, thaw, freeze, thaw. Except in a kind of Italian Morse code. C-S-C-S-C-S. 3 times each. Enzo regarded me sharply. Perhaps I wasn't a waste of time after all. He finished his experiment and then asked me if I wanted a coffee. He made 2 cups. Something had thawed between us. We became friends. He taught me virology, cell culture, T-cell biology, Italian slang, and the secret to making a good bolognese. I would bike uphill every morning through the incessant rain to work with him and bike down every evening in the rain again. I came and went as I pleased, sometimes up and down the hill at midnight, while my experiments cooked in the laboratory incubators. My inner world was suffused by thoughts about T-cells and their interactions with chronic viruses. I would rethink my experiments as I biked downhill, running through the data in my head, imagining the life of the virus inside the cell. To understand T-cell virology, learn to think like a virus, Enzo told me. And so I did. I would become EBV one afternoon and herpes the next. The latter involved having some sense of humor. Even after I left Oxford, Enzo and I continued to collaborate, publishing papers together. He sent me vials of cells for my experiments in the lab. I sent him recipes from my mother for his experiments in the kitchen. We met at seminars across the globe, each time resuming our conversation as if we had never left off from the last one. Our interests had shifted, almost simultaneously, from immunology to cancer, and finally to the immunology of cancer. Over the decades, I matured from a mentee to a colleague and friend, but I could never make Enzo an espresso that he found satisfactory. I tried once, and he spat it out. It was, as Wolfgang Pauli might have put it, so bad that it was not even wrong. In early 2019, I learned that Enzo had been diagnosed with advanced lung cancer. The news of his illness numbed me with shock. I couldn't bring myself to call him for days. A week passed, perhaps two, until I finally dialed his number from New York. He picked up immediately. He was matter-of-fact about his condition. Perhaps those T-cells whose inner mysteries he had spent his life uncovering would find a way to fight his cancer. As Alan Townsend wrote about Enzo in the journal Nature Immunology, one hears the phrase fight with cancer, but this description is a pale shadow of the intense, personal, grinding immunological battle he waged with the rebellious cells that challenged him. He grappled and wrestled with every resource he could muster at home and from around the world, employing every bit of his deep knowledge and experience. He did this, unperturbed, never missing a seminar, always available to his students and colleagues. It was a demonstration of supreme courage. In 2020, a few weeks before I was about to visit Oxford to deliver a talk, I found out that Enzo had died. I canceled my trip. That evening, I sat in the lab silently, recalling my mentor, my Bolognese instructor, my friend, holding back the memories until they had hardened. I felt dazed, desiccated, congealed in gloom. It was only then, hours later, that the grief burst inside me in wave upon liquid wave. Congelare, scongelare. Inner worlds, outer worlds, separated by membranes. What do T-cells do during an infection? Imagine, as a human immune system might see it, that there are two pathological worlds of microbes. There is an outer world of a bacterium or a virus floating outside the cell, in lymph fluid or blood, or in tissues, and there is an inner world of a virus that is embedded and living within a cell. It is the latter world that presents a metaphysical, or rather a physical, problem. A cell, we said before, is a bounded autonomous entity with a membrane that seals it from the outside. It's inside the cytoplasm, the nucleus, is a closed sanctum, largely inscrutable from the outside, except for the signals, or receptors, that the cell chooses to send to its surface. But what if a virus has taken residence within a cell? What about, say, a flu virus that has infiltrated the cell and hijacked its protein-making apparatus in order to churn out viral proteins that are indistinguishable from the cell's own? This is what viruses do. They go native. A flu virus turns its hostage into a veritable flu factory, producing thousands of virions per hour. And because antibodies cannot enter cells, how are they to identify one of these rogue cells masquerading as a normal cell? What then prevents any virus from using every cell in our body as a perfect microbial sanctuary? The answers to all these questions, I would soon find out, lay in the cell whose seductive song had tugged me all the way from California to Alan Townsend's lab at Oxford. The cell that could, with nearly miraculous sensitivity, discern a virus-infected cell from an uninfected one, and the cell that can discriminate the self from the non-self. The subtle, wise, discerning T-cell. In the 1970s, Rolf Zinkernagel and Peter Doherty, immunologists working in Australia, found the first clue to decipher T-cell recognition. They began with so-called killer T-cells, T-lymphocytes that recognize virus-infected cells and souse them with toxins until they shrivel and die, thereby purging the microbe taking refuge there. The cytotoxic, cell-killing T-cells brandished a particular marker on their surfaces, CD8, a type of protein. The peculiar thing about these CD8-positive T-cells, Zinkernagel and Doherty discovered, was that they had a capacity to recognize viral infections only in the context of the self. Consider that thought. Your T-cells can recognize virally infected cells only if they come from your body, not someone else's. If the T-cell and the target cell are unmatched, meaning that they come from different bodies and carry different protein markers on their surfaces, then the immune system will kill them anyway, regardless of whether they are infected. This is the basis for graft rejection. If you implant a stranger's cells into your body, those cells will be rejected. We will return to this non-self recognition later. A second feature of killer T's was just as puzzling. Although a CD8 T-cell could recognize a cell from the same body, it killed only infected cells from the same body. No viral infection, no kill. It was as if the T-cell was capable of asking two independent questions. First, does the cell that I am surveying belong to my body? In other words, is it self? And second, is it infected with a virus or a bacterium? Has the self been changed? Only if both were true, the self and infection, would a T-cell kill its target. In short, T-cells had evolved to recognize self, but an altered self that happens to harbor an infection. But how? Using genetic techniques, Zinkernagel and Doherty tracked the detection of the self to a set of molecules called MHC class 1. The MHC class 1 protein comes in thousands of variants. Each of us carries a unique combination of MHC class 1 genes. It is this self MHC that the T-cell first detects. If the infected cell and the CD8 T-cell come from a person with the same MHC class 1, then recognition happens and the infected cell is killed. It is as if the MHC protein is a frame. Without the right frame or context, yourself, the T-cell cannot even see the picture, even if it is a distorted version of the self. And without the picture in the frame, presumably some part of the virus, an infected self, again, the T-cell cannot recognize the infected cell. It needs both the pathogen and the self, the picture and the frame. There's presumably a deep evolutionary logic behind this. A peptide fragment displayed by a macrophage or a monocyte indicates a bona fide infection. A free-floating one, lacking the frame provided by a phagocytic cell and not presented appropriately, might be incidental debris or, worse, a fragment from a human cell. Mounting an immune response to the self fragment would unleash autoimmunity, a devastating consequence of T-cell immunity. Zinkernagel and Doherty had solved one piece of the puzzle, that T-cells recognize the infected self, but the second piece was just as thorny a problem. This molecule, MHC class 1, is involved, yes, but how does a cell signal an altered self? In other words, a self with an infection. How does a CD8 cell find a self cell with a flu virus embedded within it? Alan Townsend, my former advisor, who has over the years become a close friend, took up this question in the 1990s, first at Mill Hill in London and then at Oxford. Alan is among the most brilliant and prescient scientists I have ever met. He was, at times, the very caricature of the Oxford academic. He despised traveling to scientific meetings in exotic destinations. The word tropical inspired terror. He ate doughy, meat-filled pasties for lunch virtually every day, and he had perfected the English habit of deadly euphemism. If he thought an idea was stupid or unscientific, he would look vaguely into the distance, pause, and say, "Oh, that notion seems, rather subtle." At lab meetings, I must confess, I was often rather subtle. In the late 1980s and early 1990s, Townsend, among others, began to uncover how a killer T-cell detects a virus-infected cell. Townsend began his experiments with CD8 killer T-cells. His particular interest was cells infected with the influenza virus. How are these infected cells recognized and cleared? Just as Zinker, Nagel, and Doherty had demonstrated previously, Townsend found CD8 T-cells would kill flu-infected cells that came from the same body. In other words, they depended on the recognition of the self. But, as mentioned before, the self cell had to carry an infection and the expression of a viral protein to be killed. What viral protein was being recognized? Some of these killer T-cells, researchers had found, were detecting the presence of the influenza protein, called nucleoprotein, NP, inside a flu-infected cell. Nucleoprotein is an influenza protein that is made inside the cell. It is then packaged into the influenza virion. The protein has no signals to enable it to reach the surface of the cell, hence Alan Townsend's puzzlement about how a T-cell could possibly detect it. But that's where the mystery began. It was an inside-outside problem. "That protein, NP, never makes it to the cell surface," Alan told me. We were sitting in a London taxicab, returning from a lecture. It was dusk, London dusk with its sudden shards of oblique English light, and the streets as we moved through them, Regent Street, Bury Street, were full of endless rows of houses with partially lit windows and impregnable doors. How could a detective moving door to door find a resident inside one of these houses unless the person happened to poke his head outside? T-cells can't get inside cells. There are membranes that separate them. But then how can a T-cell assess the components of the inside of an infected cell? "NP is always inside the cell," Alan continued. His eyes were shining, glowering now as he remembered the experiments. He performed the most sensitive tests, assay upon assay, week upon week, to find even the faintest trace of the NP protein on the flu-infected cell's surface, where a T-cell might detect it. But it wasn't there. It never pokes its head out of the cell's membrane. As far as cell surface proteins are concerned, there is nothing for a NP-detecting T-cell to see, he said. "It's invisible on the cell surface. It isn't even there, and yet it's perfectly visible to the T-cell." The taxi halted at a flickering light, as if waiting for an answer. How, then, was the T-cell detecting NP? The crucial discoveries came in the late 1980s. The CD8 killer cells, Alan found, were not recognizing the intact NP poking its face outside the cell. Rather, the cells were detecting viral peptides, small pieces or fragments of the viral protein NP. And, crucially, these peptides had to be presented to the T-cells on the right frame, in this case carried or loaded by the MHC class 1 protein, and brought to the surface of the cell. The self, yes, but the altered self. The MHC class 1 protein, the very protein that Zinker, Nagel, and Doherty had implicated in the killer T-cell response, was actually a carrier, a peptide bearer, and a frame. The MHC was turning the inside to the outside, constantly sending out a sampling of a cell's innards. Imagine it as a spy, our man in Havana, sending out semaphores about a cell's interior for the immune system to recognize. The T-cell needs the right spy, therefore the requirement for self-recognition, and it needs the right semaphore, therefore the requirement for a foreign pathogen inside a cell. It is yet another example of biology's codes. Combine the right inside man and the right semaphore, the self-MHC carrying a piece of a viral peptide, and the T-cell moves in for its kill. In biology, there is rarely a more poignant moment than when a structure of a molecule melds with its function. What a molecule looks like and what it does fall into perfect union. Take DNA, the iconic double helix. It looks like an information carrier, a string of four chemicals, A, C, T, and G, with a unique sequence, A, C, T, G, G, C, C, T, G, C, just like a four-letter Morse code. The double helix also allows us to understand how replication occurs. The strands are complementary, yin and yang. The A on one strand is matched with T on the other, and C matched with G. When a cell divides to make two copies of DNA, each strand serves as a template to make the other. The yin dictates the formation of the yang. The yang shapes the yin, and two new yin-yang double helices of DNA are formed. The sperm's tail that whips around to make the sperm squirm toward the egg looks like a tail, except that it is built out of an assemblage of proteins. The motor that makes the tail spin resembles a motor with a set of moving parts arranged in a circle. And the hook that connects the motor to the tail, transforming circular motion to the propeller-like swimming motion of the sperm, looks like a hook engineered precisely to achieve this transformation. And so it was with the MHC Class I. When its structure was finally solved by the crystallographer Pam Bjorkman at Caltech University, it seemed to fall into perfect step with its function. The molecule looks, well, as you might expect, like a hand holding up two open halves of a hot dog bun. The two sides of a bun, two protein helices of the MHC molecule, leave a perfect groove in the middle. The viral peptide ready to be presented is the sausage stuck in the groove between the two halves of the bun, waiting to be served to a T cell. "Everything came together in that image. Everything clicked," Allen said. The foreign element, the viral peptide in its groove, and the self-element, the spiral MHC edges of the molecule, are both visible to the T-cell. Allen was infinitely moved by looking at that structure. He could actually visualize the presentation of a viral peptide to a T-cell. Every immunologist's pulse will race as he or she sees the three-dimensional structure of the binding site of an MHC molecule displayed for the first time, he wrote in the pages of Nature. Because it will explain the structural basis of antigen recognition. That image of the Class I molecule answered 1,000 questions from immunologists and raised 1,000 more. Allen titled his 1987 article with a fragment of a poem borrowed from William Butler Yeats, "Those images that yet fresh images beget." And indeed, the image of the MHC with its bound peptide begot fresh images. What about the MHC Class I allows T-cell recognition? And since the MHC Class I, the carrier protein, is a molecular platter that displays both self and foreign elements, what about the structure of the cognate recognition molecule on the T-cell surface?
What does the protein that detects the carrier MHC peptide complex look like?
At around the same time that the molecular structure of the MHC Class I was solved, several groups, including Mark Davis's at Stanford, Tack Max in Toronto, and Jim Allison's in Houston, homed in on the gene that encodes the T-cell receptor, the molecule on the T-cell that recognizes the MHC bound to the peptide. And when its structure was finally solved, there was, yet again, a profound matching of structure and function. The T-cell receptor looks like two outstretched fingers. Parts of the two fingers touch the self, that is, the raised hinges of the MHC molecule around the sides of the peptide, and parts of it touch the foreign peptide carried in its groove. Both self and foreign are recognized simultaneously. The two requirements for the detection of an infected cell are contained in the structure. One part of a finger touches the self, one part makes contact with the foreign. When both are touched, recognition is achieved. The matching of form and function is one of biology's most beautiful ideas, first articulated centuries ago by thinkers such as Aristotle. In the structures of the two molecules, MHC and T-cell receptor, one can identify the fundamental themes of immunology and cell biology, Our immune system is built on both the recognition of self and of its distortion. It is designed by evolution to detect the altered self. As Allen concluded in his seminal article, T-cell recognition can now be explored in a rational way. Let's leave aside the matching of structures and functions for a moment. The solution to the problem of T-cell recognition, Townsend knew, had created another problem. It had begotten yet another fresh image. How did a viral protein, let's say NP, synthesized inside a cell, make its way outside to where a T-cell might find it? As their molecular studies deepened, Townsend and others began to uncover an elaborate internal apparatus that would precisely accomplish this task of turning the cell's innards inside out to display it to the outside world. The process begins, we now know, as soon as the viral protein is made inside the cell. The cell doesn't know whether the protein is part of its normal repertoire or whether it's foreign. There's no special feature of a viral protein that identifies it as viral. And so, like all proteins, NP is eventually sent into the inherent waste disposal mechanism of the cell's meat grinder, the proteasome, that then chews them into smaller pieces, peptides, and ejects the peptides into the cell. And then, using special channels, these peptides are transported into a compartment where they can be loaded onto MHC class 1s. The loaded class 1 proteins carry the viral peptides to the cell surface and present them to the T-cell. The class 1 molecules, as their structures indicated, are like molecular platters, constantly presenting teasers, amuse-bouche, of the cell's insides for T-cell surveillance. It is one of the cleverest ways of repurposing a cell's intrinsic molecular apparatus. It takes the natural waste disposal factory of the body, treats the viral protein as if it were any other protein meant for disposal, mounts it on a protein carrier, and pushes it out of a hatch and onto the cell surface. The inside is now outside. The cell has sent a sampling of its inner life, bound in the correct frame, to be surveyed by the immune system. When a CD8 cell comes by, sniffing the cell surface, it will find a large selection of peptides from the interior of a cell loaded on its surface, including, of course, the peptide from the virus. And only if that foreign peptide is presented by the self MHC, the altered self, will it trigger an immune response, killing the infected cell. So far, we focused on the inner world of the cell, that is, on pathogens lodged inside a cell. But the outer world, when pathogens are free-floating in the body, presents its own questions. How do viruses and bacteria present outside the cell activate a T-cell response? In principle, activating a T-cell response before a virus has infected its target cell, while it's still coursing through the blood, say, or moving through the lymph system, would carry many advantages for an organism. It could prepare the various wings of the immune response for the impending infection. It could trigger alarms in the body, fevers, inflammation, and the production of antibodies, all in an effort to thwart the infection at an early stage. As we've discussed already, the cells of the innate immune system, macrophages, neutrophils, and monocytes, are constantly surveying the body to find signs of injuries and infections. Once such an infection is detected, these cells swarm to the infected site to ingest, or phagocytose, bacterial cells or the viral particles. They devour the invaders, internalize them, and route them to special compartments. These compartments, lysosomes among them, are chock-full of enzymes to degrade the virus into smaller fragments, including those bits and pieces of proteins known as peptides. This, too, is a form of internalization, although not an internalization that causes infection. Here, the virus is noticeably a foreigner, destined for destruction. It is yet to enter a cell, make new virions, and go native. Alan Townsend's work discussed earlier had focused on the CD8 T-cell response that occurs after a virus has sheltered itself inside a cell. But what about readying a T-cell response as soon as the surveillance system in the body has detected a pathogen? In the 1990s, Emil Unanue, now a professor at the Washington University School of Medicine, began to explore the T-cell response to microbes outside the cell. This form of immune detection, he discovered, follows nearly analogous principles to the ones that Townsend had found. Once phagocytosed, targeted to the lysosome and degraded, bacteria and viruses are chopped into peptides. A word of caution here. A small fraction of peptides from the interior of the cell, typically waste products, are also sent to the lysosome for destruction and are presented on class 2 MHCs. And just as the class 1 MHC molecule frames and presents a cell's internal peptides to T cells, a related class of proteins, called class 2 MHCs, presents mostly external peptides to T cells. Its structure, too, is similar, a hand holding up two halves of a bun, with a groove for the peptide in the middle. This process is illustrated in the attached PDF. But it's here that the immune response diversifies, incorporating a second wing of attack. The internal peptides, presented by class 1 MHCs, as Zinkernagel and Doherty had found, are detected by a set of T cells called CD8 killer T cells. The CD8 cells, you'll remember, kill the infected cell, purging the virus in the process. In contrast, a majority of peptides derived from pathogens outside the cell, and a few from the cell's interior that end up in the lysosome, are presented by class 2 MHCs. These are detected by a second class of T cells called CD4 T cells. The CD4 T cell isn't a killer. Again, there's a logic to this. The virus is already dead and minced to pieces. Why kill the cell that's alerting the T cell to a dead virus? Rather, this T cell is an orchestrator. Having sensed the MHC2 peptide complex, the CD4 cell begins to coordinate an immune response. It incites B cells to start synthesizing antibodies. It secretes substances that amplify the macrophage's capacity to phagocytose. It causes an upsurge of local blood flow and summons yet other immune cells, including B cells, to challenge the infection. In the absence of the CD4 cell, the transition between innate immunity and adaptive immunity, that is, between the detection of a pathogen and antibody production by B cells, would fall apart. For all these properties, and especially for supporting the B cell antibody response, this type of cell is called the helper T cell. Its job is to bridge the innate and adaptive immune system, macrophages and monocytes on one end, and B and T cells on the other. So desperate and so constant is our battle with pathogens that even the helper needs helpers. Many different kinds of cells, monocytes, macrophages, and neutrophils that we've encountered earlier, can present peptide MHC complexes, those molecular platters loaded with their inner contents to engage helper and killer T cells. This is, after all, a general surveillance system for virus-infected cells, but there's a specialized cell so acutely attuned to engaging a T cell, so inherently specialized for antigen presentation, that its main and only function may be to detect pathogens and spark an immune response. This cell, discovered by the scientist Ralph Steinman, lives mainly in the spleen and sends out dozens of branches, almost beckoning the T cell to come and look. Steinman had found them by looking through a microscope in the 1970s and spent nearly four decades deciphering their function. This cell possesses one of the most effective mechanisms to trap viruses and bacteria, one of the most efficient processing systems to present peptide MHC complexes, the densest collection of surface molecules to activate T cells, and among the most potent mechanisms to secrete molecular alarm bells that activate both the adaptive and innate immune responses. It is called the dendritic cell, from the Greek word for branch, for the many branches and fingerlings that extend from its body.
One might almost imagine these branches evolved to create separate docking sites for T cells.
But metaphorically, too, it is many-branched, capable of coordinating every aspect of the multi-pronged immune system and prime it to respond to an infection. The dendritic cell, perhaps, is the first among the first responders to jumpstart immunity to a pathogen. Ralph Steinman died in New York on September 30, 2017, a few days before the Nobel Prize Committee awarded him the prize for his discovery. For a while, tragically, there was a prize, but no prize winner. The Nobel is not awarded posthumously, but the decision to award Steinman the prize had been made long before his death, and so the honor was still conferred on him. Obituaries and tributes to Steinman poured out from scientists, physicians, and Steinman's trainees, but the one tribute that I find the most evocative, written by the Seattle immunologist Phil Greenberg, carries a title that brings us back to the very roots of cell biology. To Leeuwenhoek, Hooke, and Virchow, looking down their scopes and unveiling a new cosmos of biology. The article is called Ralph M. Steinman, A Man, A Microscope, A Cell, and So Much More. It is the story of virtually every researcher who inhabits this audiobook, captured in three words: a scientist, a scope, a cell. Antigen processing and presentation to CD4 and CD8 cells, the mainstays of T-cell recognition, are slow but painstakingly methodical processes. Unlike an antibody, a gun-slinging sheriff itching for a showdown with a gang of molecular criminals in the center of town, a T-cell is the gumshoe detective going door to door to look for perpetrators hiding inside. In The Lives of a Cell, Lewis Thomas wrote, "Lymphocytes, like wasps, are genetically programmed for exploration, but each of them seems to be permitted a different solitary idea. They roam through the tissue, sensing and monitoring." Unlike the B-cell, though, the T-cell isn't looking for a culprit to come bursting out of the saloon, guns a-blazing. It is, like some omniscient Sherlock Holmes with a pipe and an umbrella, seeking the portent of a person, the debris left behind by an inner presence, a torn-up letter with the fragment of a name discarded in the trash can outside. You might think of that crumpled piece of stationery mounted within a trash can as a peptide presented on an MHC molecule. There is a duality in the immune system. One recognition system needs no cellular context, B cells and antibodies, while the other is triggered only when the foreign protein is presented in the context of a cell, T cells. It's this duality that ensures that viruses and bacteria are not just cleared from the blood by antibodies, but are also cleared from infected cells where they could otherwise be harbored safely, by T cells. It is, contrary to Allen's use of the word, truly rather subtle. The first patients began to arrive at hospitals and clinics in 1979 and 1980. It was the winter of 79, and a Los Angeles doctor, Joel Weissman, noted a spike in the number of young men, typically in their 20s and 30s, presenting to his clinic with a bizarre illness, a mononucleosis-like syndrome marked by a hectic fever, weight loss, and swollen lymph nodes. On the other side of the country, similar clusters of unusual illnesses had also begun to emerge suddenly. In March 1980, in New York, a patient named Nick came down with an odd wasting disease, lassitude, weight loss, and a slow consumption of the whole body. By early 1980, there were more patients, again, primarily young men in New York and Los Angeles, many of whom had acquired a form of pneumonia seen previously only in severely immunocompromised patients, caused by a pathogen that was virtually unheard of outside textbooks, pneumocystis. The disease was so rare that the only drug to treat it, pentamidine, was dispensed through a federal pharmacy. In April 1981, a pharmacist at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, CDC, noted that demand for the antifungal had almost tripled, and all the requests seemed to come from various hospitals in New York and L.A. On June 5, 1981, a landmark date, the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, MMWR, the CDC's weekly record of the nation's illnesses, published five cases of young men with pneumocystis pneumonia, PCP, noting the highly unusual fact that they had all occurred in Los Angeles, within a few miles of each other. Often, they later learned the patients were men who'd engaged in sexual contact with other men. The occurrence of pneumocystis in these five previously healthy individuals without a clinically apparent underlying immunodeficiency is unusual, the report stated. All three patients tested had abnormal cellular immune function. Two of the four reported recent homosexual contacts. All of the above observations suggest the possibility of a cellular immune dysfunction related to a common exposure that predisposes individuals to opportunistic infections. And then, on both coasts, men began showing up at doctors' offices with a rare cancer of the skin and the body's mucous membranes. Kaposi sarcoma, rarely seen in the United States, was an indolent malignancy later associated with a viral infection. It typically presented as purplish-blue skin lesions and had occasionally turned up among aged Mediterranean men and patients in an endemic belt in sub-equatorial Africa. But in New York and Los Angeles, the sarcomas were aggressive, invasive cancers, covering arms and legs with erosive violet welts that invaded the skin. In March 1981, The Lancet published a case report of 8 such cases, another peculiar cluster. By then, Nick, the man with the wasting disease, was already dead of a cavitating brain lesion caused by Toxoplasma gondii, a common, typically non-invasive pathogen found in, of all creatures, harmless household cats. By the late summer of 1981, peculiar illnesses seen previously only in severely immunocompromised patients seemed to arise out of nowhere. Week after week, the MMWR reported the grim record of a plague with 1,000 faces, composed of seemingly unconnected diseases. More cases of pneumocystis pneumonia, cryptococcal meningitis, toxoplasmosis, violet sarcomas arising in young men, strange, indolent viruses suddenly turned active and furious, unusual lymphomas surging out of nowhere. The only common epidemiological connection was that these diseases had a powerful predilection for men who had sex with other men. Although, by 1982, it was also clear that recipients of frequent blood transfusions, such as patients with the blood clotting disorder hemophilia, were also at risk. And, in virtually every case, there were signs of catastrophic immune collapse, particularly of cellular immunity. In a 1981 issue of The Lancet, a letter to the editor suggested the name gay compromise syndrome. Some called it gay-related immune deficiency, or more perversely, and with evident discriminatory intent, gay cancer. In July 1982, as doctors still searched frantically for a cause, the name of the illness was changed to acquired immunodeficiency syndrome, acronymed AIDS. But what was the cause of this immunological collapse? As early as 1981, 3 independent groups in New York and Los Angeles had studied the patients and discovered that their cellular immune systems had been decimated. Even the June 81 report in the MMWR had noted a collapse in cellular immunity. By sifting through each type of immune cell, the crucial defect was soon identified as a dysfunctional CD4 helper T cell that was also low in number. A normal CD4 count is around 500 to 1500 cells per cubic millimeter of blood. Patients with full-blown AIDS had only 50 or even 10. AIDS, as one group of researchers described it, was the first human disease to be characterized by the selective loss of a specific T cell subset, namely CD4 plus T helper / inducer cells. The threshold for AIDS was set at 200 CD4 helper T cells per cubic millimeter of blood. That an infectious agent, likely a virus, was involved was soon apparent. It could be transmitted sexually, both through homosexual and heterosexual sex, through blood transfusions, and by infected needles introduced into the bloodstream, typically for illicit intravenous drug use. Routine tests revealed no known virus or bacteria. This was an infection with an unknown virus from an unknown source that happened to attack cellular immunity. It was also a perfect storm, for such a virus is, biologically and metaphorically, a consummate pathogen, killing the very system designed to kill it. The identity of the AIDS-causing virus was finally revealed on March 20, 1983, when the French researcher, Luc Montagnier, working with Françoise Barré-Sanoussi, published a paper in Science magazine describing the isolation of a novel virus from the lymph nodes of several patients with AIDS. Over the next year, as the disease swept through Europe and America, killing thousands, virologists debated whether this virus was indeed the cause of AIDS. In 1984, biomedical researcher Robert Gallo's lab at the National Cancer Institute settled the debate for good. The team published four papers in the journal Science, providing unequivocal evidence that the new virus caused AIDS. It was christened Human Immunodeficiency Virus, or HIV. Gallo's lab described a method to cultivate the virus and developed antibodies to it that would form the basis for the first tests for infection. We typically think of AIDS as a viral disease, but it is also equally a cellular disease. The CD4 positive T cell sits at the crossroads of cellular immunity. To call it a helper cell is to call Thomas Cromwell a mid-level bureaucrat. The CD4 cell is not so much a helper as it is the master machinator of the entire immune system, the coordinator, the central nexus through which virtually all immune information flows. Its functions are diverse. Its work begins, as we heard before, when it detects peptides from pathogens loaded on class II MHC molecules and presented by cells. Then it jumpstarts the immune response, activating it, sending alarms, enabling B cell maturation, and recruiting CD8 T cells to sites of viral infection. It secretes factors that enable crosstalk between the various wings of the immune response. It is the central bridge between innate immunity and adaptive immunity, between all the cells of the immune system. The collapse of CD4 cells thus cascades rapidly into a collapse of the immune system in total. The tall, thin man who came to see me on a Friday afternoon had only one complaint. He was losing weight. No fevers, no chills, no night sweats. Yet his weight kept falling precipitously. Every day he stood on a scale at home and found that another pound had gone. He stood up to show me. He had tightened his belt buckle, hole after hole, in the last 6 months until he had reached the last of the holes, and still his pants were falling off his waist. I probed a little deeper. He was a retired real estate agent from Rhode Island. He had been married, but now lived alone. The man had an unusual affect. While totally frank about his medical symptoms and risks, he was reserved about his personal life, offering only the vaguest of details. IV drug use, I asked. No, he replied emphatically. Never. A history of cancer in the family? Yes, his father had died of colon cancer, his mother had breast cancer. Unprotected sex? He looked at me as if I were mad. No, he claimed to have been celibate for years. I performed a physical examination. Nothing stood out. Let's order the basic tests, I said. Asymptomatic weight loss is a tough medical conundrum. We would check for occult bleeding or any signs of cancer. Tuberculosis seemed like an unlikely scenario. His risk for HIV was low, but we could circle back to that. Our time having finished, he got up to leave. He was wearing sneakers with no socks on, and it was as he turned around that I saw it out of the corner of my eye, a blue-purple lesion on one ankle, just above the shoe. Come back for a minute, I told him. Take your sneakers off. I examined the lesion carefully. It was a small mound on his skin, about the size of a kidney bean, with a deep eggplant color. It looked like Kaposi's sarcoma. Let's add a CD4 count, I said, then added delicately, and an HIV test? He seemed unfazed. A week later, the numbers were back. He had full-blown AIDS. His CD4 count was 1/10 of what we consider normal, and a biopsy of the blue-purple lesion tested positive, as I suspected it would, for Kaposi's sarcoma, one of the AIDS-defining diseases. I sent the man to an HIV specialist. The next time he came to see me, he again denied vehemently any involvement in the risky behaviors associated with HIV/AIDS. No unprotected sex with men or women. No IV drug use, no blood transfusions. It was as if the virus had appeared out of thin air. There was no point in probing further. An impenetrable sheet of privacy stood between us. In his 1981 novel, Midnight's Children, Salman Rushdie writes of a doctor who is allowed to examine his patient, a young woman, only through a hole in a white sheet of cloth. It seemed at times that I could visualize my patient only through a hole in a sheet of cloth. Of what? Homophobia? Denial? Sexual shame? Addiction? We started him on antiretroviral therapy. His CD4 counts began to climb, slower than we had expected, but edging up, day by day. His weight plateaued for a while. Then it began to drop again. In an unusual plot twist, two new lesions, purple-blue, suddenly turned up on his arm. A new bruise? More Kaposi's? But the timing made no sense. By then he had begun to spike spectral fevers and chills. Lumps had appeared under his armpits, and those two new blue-black lesions enlarged. A few afternoons later, he was back in the emergency room. From there, things spun quickly out of control. His blood pressure plummeted, and his toes turned blue. His blood cultures grew out of the Bartonella bacterium often found in patients with AIDS, and the tongue twister of the case took another turn. The blue-black lesions that had grown afresh on his skin were not Kaposi's after all, but were tumor-like protrusions caused by blood vessels inflamed by Bartonella. What are the chances that two identical lesions in the same patient would have two radically different causes? Sometimes medical mysteries are deeper than we can possibly imagine. We treated him with the antibiotics doxycycline and rifampin until his symptoms subsided. He stayed in the hospital for 2 weeks. I went to see him a week into his hospitalization, and he was back to his reticent self. Bartonella is almost always caused by a cat scratch. Typically, fleas introduced into the skin by the scratch transmit the disease. We sat for a while in silence, as if each of us was figuring out a strategy in this mutual battle of concealment. "Cats?" I asked him. "You've never told me you had cats." He looked at me with puzzlement. "No cats." "No risk factors for HIV, no drugs, no unprotected sexual intercourse, no cats, no scratches." I shrugged and gave up. Fortunately, the man recovered from his infections. The antiretroviral drugs are working, and his CD4 counts have returned to normal. But the black box of causes still remains perfectly sealed. Sometimes human mysteries are deeper than medical ones. Combination antiviral drug therapy with 3 to 4 drugs has changed the landscape of HIV treatment. The pharmacopoeia against the virus has increased year by year. There are drugs that prevent the virus from replicating efficiently, drugs that prevent the virus from duplicating its RNA or integrating into the host genome, drugs that prevent the virus from maturing into infective particles, drugs that prevent the virus from fusing to the vulnerable cells. 5 or 6 separate classes of drugs in all. Therapy with these medicines is so effective that patients with HIV can live for decades without any sign of the virus. Undetectable, in the parlance of medicine. They are not cured, but so deeply controlled with such vanishingly low viral loads that they cannot infect others. And laboratories around the globe are hunting for vaccines against HIV that might prevent infection altogether, thus eliminating the need for chronic multi-drug therapy. Indeed, some of the most far-reaching drug trials have moved from treatment to prevention. In one study, a 2-dose regimen of the antiviral nevirapine, prescribed to an HIV-positive mother before delivery, and 1 dose given to the newborn within 3 days of birth, decreased the risk of transmission from 25% to about 12%. It costs around $4. More potent combinations of drugs to prevent transmission in pregnant mothers or in high-risk individuals after sexual contact are being put to the test virtually every month. But while we await the HIV vaccine, at least one route to the cure of a cellular disease might involve cellular therapy. On February 7, 2007, Timothy Ray Brown, an HIV-positive man, underwent a bone marrow transplant. Brown originally from Seattle, was diagnosed with HIV in 1995 while a university student in Berlin. He had been treated with antiviral drugs, including the then-new protease inhibitors, and had lived symptom-free for a decade. His CD4 counts were barely below normal, and his viral load was undetectable. However, in 2005, he began to feel suddenly exhausted and weak, unable to finish his usual bicycle rides. He was found to be moderately anemic, even though his HIV was under control. A bone marrow biopsy revealed that Timothy had acute myelogenous leukemia, a deadly cancer of white blood cells. Brown happened to be extremely unlucky. This cancer and the HIV infection are thought to be unrelated. HIV-infected men have a higher risk of certain lymphomas, but not of AML. He was treated initially with standard chemotherapy, but the leukemia relapsed in 2006. For the next step of treatment, his oncologist suggested high doses of chemo intended to wipe out his malignant cells, and with them, his defenses against disease, followed by a bone marrow transplant from a matched donor. Such matched donors are usually hard to find, but surprisingly, Brown turned out to have a glut of 267 matches in the International Registry. And so, faced with a wealth of choices, his doctor, Gero Hüther, a Berlin hematologist with an experimental bent, suggested seeking a donor who also happened to have a natural mutation in CCR5, the co-receptor that HIV uses to enter CD4 cells. In some humans, all cells, including CD4 cells, have a natural mutation in the CCR5 gene called CCR5 delta 32. The very same mutation that Chinese geneticist He Jiankui had tried to create in Lulu and Nana via gene editing. Humans who inherit two copies of this mutant CCR5 gene are resistant to HIV infection. Brown's transplant, then, would be not just an innovative medical treatment, but also a once-in-a-lifetime experiment. Hüther knew of an earlier patient, also from Berlin, who had been taken off HIV drugs because he was thought to have naturally inherited a gene that conferred resistance to HIV. The patient's viral load had not rebounded even after his HIV meds had been discontinued. Suggestive evidence, but not solid proof, that a patient's genetic background could alter his or her susceptibility to HIV. Brown's case, Hüther knew, would represent a significant leap forward. For one thing, the stem cell donor, not the host, would supply the resistance gene. And although the primary goal of the transplantation was to cure Timothy Brown's leukemia, Hüther reasoned, why not try to defeat the HIV infection in the same cellular swoop? Unfortunately, the leukemia recurred a little more than a year after the transplant, necessitating a second attempt using stem cells from the same donor. It was an intensely grueling ordeal. I became delirious, nearly went blind, and was almost paralyzed, Brown wrote in a reflective article in 2015, the 20th anniversary of his cancer diagnosis. Recovery took months, and then years. Gradually, he relearned to walk, and his vision was restored. But he stayed off his HIV medicines, as had been planned after the first transplant. And as the new stem cells with the naturally resistant version of CCR5 delta 32 cells engrafted, he remained HIV negative. He was cured of leukemia, and perhaps more astonishingly, of HIV. Brown's case is still widely discussed in the medical community. Initially referred to anonymously as the Berlin patient, Brown decided to reveal his identity in the media and in scientific journals in early 2010, the year he returned to the United States. He remained HIV-free for 13 years and began to refer to himself as cured. In 2020, Timothy Ray Brown died of relapsed leukemia at the age of 54, but still with no sign of HIV in his blood. Let's make one fact clear. The world's pandemic of HIV is not going to be solved by bone marrow transplantation with CCR5 delta 32 donor cells. The procedure is far too expensive, too toxic, and too labor-intensive to be considered a practical option for a large swath of the human population. But there are potent lessons and open questions in Brown's story that are relevant for vaccine and antiviral drug development. First, altering the cellular reservoir of HIV in the blood can potentially cure the disease, or at least achieve deep permanent control on viremia. In the wake of Timothy Brown's HIV cure, a second patient in London was also cured of HIV with a bone marrow transplant. Unless these two cases are anomalies, it is unlikely that there is a secret reservoir beyond blood where HIV might hide and get reactivated when the drugs are discontinued, a potential problem that has concerned researchers for decades. Note that I specified blood, not just CD4 T cells. Macrophages, also derived from blood, for instance, are known to act as reservoirs for HIV. It is impossible to know whether a dormant reservoir of HIV remained in Brown's body after his supposed cure, but the fact is that he had lived virus-free for more than a dozen years. And if there were such stores in his remnant macrophages, then perhaps the virus, unable to infect his CD4-positive T cells, was permanently trapped, like a man under a locked cellar door. What factors had contributed to the potential cure? The particular strain of HIV? The low viral load before the transplants? The engineering of Brown's immune system after the transplant? Answers to these questions will guide the next wave of HIV therapies. We will learn about where the virus hides, how to attack its reservoirs, how cells might resist infection. Most importantly, we'll learn about how the immune system can be taught to recognize this most devious of pathogens.